CliffCentral.com. It is Thursday. It's the last day of October, the day after the medium-term budget speech, and we're going to talk in a moment on the Burning Platform with Canthan Pillay. Darby Skultz will have your thoughts and comments too. You can join us on 079-748-2090 if you have something to say. But I must remind you, Blind History is up and running, and there is a new episode out this week. You can find out by going to cliffcentral.com. You can get to the Blind History page on cliffcentral.com and find out how you can get 20% off when you buy from Taylor Blinds and Shutters using the promo code BLINDHISTORY. Blind History are the magic words, and then you can get 20% off. So if you're looking at doing something with your windows, or as somebody who messaged us yesterday and said, I don't even have windows and I want some, you can do that by using the code BLINDHISTORY to get 20% off. It's a special offer if you're a listener to the Blind History series. Okay, it's time for the Burning Platform. Brought to you by Nando's. On the line is Canthan Pillay. Hey, Canthan, how are you?
I'm awesome. How are you doing?
Good. Again, a quiet week with nothing really to talk about, so we should be finished in about 5 minutes, right?
I sincerely hope so.
So first of all, I've got to welcome Darby as well. It's always nice to have someone in the studio, and we've been watching your tweets, Darby, with quite a lot of interest. We've also been paying attention to the articles you've written. Can I first have both of your impressions on the budget speech yesterday, the medium-term budget speech? Canthan, you start.
Well, I think it's not so much my impressions as much as what the markets did, because the rand promptly tanked. It sank from around about 14.50 to the dollar, and immediately went, almost immediately went to over 15 to the dollar. So clearly the sentiment around the world was that, Tito, you tried, but actually, we don't believe you.
Yeah.
Yes, and so I think that if you want an executive summary of what was actually wrong in terms of the budget speech, it was that. It certainly did not go far enough in terms of addressing everything that people actually expected if the Ramaphosa government was really serious about getting the economic fundamentals right. I think the single biggest thing that left disappointment in the eyes of many observers is the fact that even though there was a commitment to scaling back on expenditure at the level of cabinet and at the senior government, there wasn't any corresponding commitment to cutting back on the single biggest millstone that we have as a country, which is, of course, the public service wage bill. The finance minister did not go anywhere in that direction at all. And given that we have a scenario where we have something like, what did he say? It was 29,000 people in the public service who are earning more than $1 million a month. I mean, that is, $1 million a year.
Yeah.
It's going to be really difficult to pull ourselves out of that mess.
Sure. And also a lot of these people who've been put into the government in the bureaucracy as government wage earners are cadres of the ANC, which is kind of how they maintain their support base within government and during elections in particular, right?
That's absolutely right. But let's also bear in mind that that figure of 29,000 does not include people who are employed by the state-owned enterprises and by the parastatals in general, because those count.
Which is many thousands more.
Yes. Well, certainly, yeah. I don't have an exact breakdown of numbers, but it's huge.
All right, let me introduce Darby quickly. Darby Skultz is a consultant at the Joburg office of the Boston Consulting Group. He has completed an MBA from the University of Cape Town, MAM from Yale University, and has worked with a number of South African companies across a range of topics, including large-scale project implementation, operating model restructuring, due diligence for potential acquisitions, and long-term growth strategy. Additionally, he has a special interest in South African politics and public policy. So we've been hoping to get you in here for a long time, Darby, so it's nice to see you.
It's great to be here.
Thank you. You probably agree with a lot of what Canthan said. Do you want to add something to it?
I think the speech was really, really worrying for me on really two fronts, because it fails to even scratch the surface of what I think is really required on two things. So we're in serious trouble, I think, in South Africa in terms of our sort of broad economic policy framework, which is kind of creating serious competitiveness problems for South Africa, right? And I think it manifests itself in the form of companies not choosing to invest here simply because our policy framework creates an environment for suboptimal returns on capital, right? And all of this stuff about, like, you know, how much money is going to be spent on a particular government thing and how many public sector people there are and so on is actually, in the broader picture of things, I think, chump change if we don't change the broader policy environment to actually foster growth in the economy. And Mboweni didn't touch on any of that, in my view, at all. So that's the one, I think, big concern for me. And the other concern is, I think, on the fiscal situation, there's a little bit of a lack of clarity on how to deal with some of the very big structural issues. And I think the fiscal situation can't be discussed without a detailed discussion of Eskom and SAA and what exactly will happen there. And I think the reality is that government will shoulder a very, very large portion of that debt, and it's unavoidable. And pretending that that's not the case is not, I think, going to be productive.
Not sensible. There's no other way.
Exactly.
Well, Canton, this is something you've been saying for a long time, too, when it comes to Eskom, right?
Which particular part are you talking about, Gareth?
Well, the part about the debt, that ultimately this is going to be shouldered by government and therefore by us.
Yes, ultimately, you know, the whole idea of continuing to hold the debt within Eskom, you know, my suggestion was that they should simply take the entire debt, absorb it into the fiscus, and reset Eskom so that it could actually start from zero base and began pricing its products accordingly without needing to carry those interest payments. And that will then allow us to get a real sense of where it's actually going. But I think if we look in terms of what the minister said in terms of effectively turning Eskom into three companies, well, you see, in fact, what he is doing is setting up three companies at a managerial level, if not at a legal level. And I think this is not an unimportant thing if you think about it, because it would be really difficult for him at this stage to set up three separate companies, because that means three separate CEOs, you know, three separate boards of directors and all of that kind of stuff. And it just means additional expenses.
Yeah.
But by splitting them operationally in the short term, he's already laying the groundwork for that to start happening so that we can actually have a real measure in terms of how these various units are performing.
Do you think that's a good thing? Because it sounds to me like you're halfway between this is just going to add administration and create new room for corruption. Or
no, look,
the alternative that you actually think might be optimal.
I think it is an important thing because right now everything gets bundled into one basket and we have no idea to what extent the various business units, you know, generation and distribution and so forth, whether they're performing efficiently or not. And this allows us to actually turn a spotlight upon those. Look, the question, of course, is which parts of it can actually be outsourced and which parts of it need to be within the hands of, shall we say, a state-controlled entity. I think certainly for the foreseeable future, the distribution network is going to be in the hands of the of a state-owned entity. But as we have an increasing prevalence of independent power producers, we are going to need to be measuring those each on their own, along with the way in which the individual power stations themselves are operating. So, for example, if you know we see that you know Medupi is generating electricity at I don't know 100,000 rand megawatt hour or versus 200,000 rand a megawatt hour for Kusile or 300,000 an hour from an independent power producer. That's giving us an immediate sense of where we should be focusing our attention in terms of what's most efficient for the economy. So we haven't been able to do that up until now. So, you know, if you consider that we have old power stations that, effectively the book value on the power stations is now probably zero because they've been capitalized years ago, but they continue to generate electricity, which actually makes the cost per megawatt relatively cheap. Whereas you have these new entities like Medupi and Kusile, where we're effectively paying off the construction of those, and so the cost per megawatt becomes much higher. So I think this is the most significant part of what Tito Mboweni has done, and I think it's a good thing, but certainly as I suspected, it would not be good enough from the point of view of the markets.
All right, Davi gave a wry smile while you were talking about your plans for Eskom. Davi, do you agree or disagree with Canton in terms of the fact that, first of all, it's a good idea to split these things up? Second of all, that the best way to deal with this debt is for government to absorb it and start from scratch?
So I think I definitely agree that it's a good idea to split it up because it creates a long-term framework for private competition to enter, right? Mm-hmm. If it's split up, and particularly if transmission is split out, and there's a buyer for electricity that sits between Eskom and the transmission network, mm-hmm. then private players can actually sell to this buyer. Right now they have to sell to Eskom, which kind of puts Eskom in the position of being the referee and the player in the game, right? So I think it's financially in the immediate term good to split. It's probably long-term structurally good to split. I think in terms of fixing the problem we have now with financial sustainability at Eskom, I think it's a very, very big hole that we have to fill, basically. And I don't think government can fill the hole on its own. I think there's some massive contribution required from government, obviously. I think probably contribution required from society in most likely higher electricity tariffs going forward.
Oh, for sure. There's no way escaping that.
And I think Eskom needs to carry some of the burden internally based on the reforms that need to occur there that have been in discussion for a long time.
All right, so I hate that we have to spend so much time talking about a power utility because it's, first of all, the most boring thing in the world. Second of all, we all already accept that it's the worst-run business in the world. And third of all, I'm just tired of having to go over old territory here. I'm sure that government must be sick of this too. Do you think it's dawned on them how badly they've administered and run and tried to facilitate operation within all of our state-owned enterprises? Or do you still think that they imagine they've done a great job? Canton, any idea here? Because you see ministers smiling. You see Pravin, who's running public enterprises. He seems like he's got things under control. Do you think deep in the night when no one's looking, these people break into a cold sweat and realize what they've fucked up?
No, I don't think so, because as long as the rest of the economy continues to take over, they're still relatively comfortable. You know, yes, their salaries have been frozen for the foreseeable future, but I think, you know, a lot of us right now, if we were in that bracket where we were earning more than R1 million a year, we'd be very happy to have our salaries frozen for, you know, the next 5 to 10 years, because, you know, that still puts us in the top 1% of income earners in this country. Mm-hmm. So I certainly don't think that they are feeling the pain at a personal level. I do think, though, that that Tito Mboweni has his hands tied. I think that if you consider the stuff that he said ahead of the budget speech, and you know, he said things like he does want to privatize SAA or to sell it off and shut it down. He does want to get rid of SAA Express, and he made a very significant point that it's really outrageous that government is subsidizing travel for rich people, which is effectively what SAA is doing, mm-hmm. and not subsidizing travel for the poorest of the poor who get stuck on trains. At which point he looked at Cyril knowingly, because you might remember Cyril got stuck on a metro rail train.
I do remember that. That was very embarrassing for a whole day.
Yes.
And then it was then it was suddenly put on the back burner, because really, yes, really government haven't, you know, I mean, we hear even the new Minister of Transport, Fikile Mbalula, there's a lot of lip service being paid to poor people, and oh shame, you can't get from A to B, and you know, travel's so difficult, and taxis and blah blah blah. Actually, they're not making any real moves to address these problems for ordinary people, are they?
Which one of us do you want to go with that?
You do. Well, I know yours is going to be sarcastic. Davi, what do you think? Am I being unfair?
Look, I mean, I think if you're Tito Mboweni or Cyril Ramaphosa and you see these problems, I think you see them for what they are, and I think you recognize that there are massive structural problems in the economy right now.
Right.
But it just must be so frustrating
to
be in this political party and be in this power dynamic in your party where you can't where you constantly have to think about, you know, what the unions are going to want, what the SACP are going to want, and this to me is the tragedy of South Africa right now and of the ANC, in that the solutions I think are really quite clear. There are people there that see it, that want to implement it, and I think that can implement it. But we are bound by politics and by our, and sorry to say, in government obsession with maintaining this kind of loyalty to the tripartite alliance. And we're just going to have to get over it, because I think we're getting to the point that practicality and actually starting to get the real reforms done is becoming non-negotiable. Because I want to connect to something that Anthea said before I came in. I was listening to the conversation you guys have. You know, there's a lot of talk about the IMF and all this stuff, right? Mm-hmm. The IMF thing doesn't really happen unless you have a lot of foreign denominated debt, because governments can always print money in their own currency. And Anthea is correct. We are now, for the first time, starting to raise a lot of foreign denominated debt. So it's getting into that portion of the game where actually, it's starting to get a little bit dangerous now. Mm-hmm. And real structural reform is required soon, and I don't see it happening in the ANC in the current setup. And that, it's really worrying.
Okay, but this debt and this talk of IMF bailouts and all the rest of it, if our debt continues to escalate at the rate at which it seems Tito is starting to indicate it will, then surely that's an inevitability. And wouldn't that inevitability be better than the ANC continuing to administer the economy?
Yes, but there's something else which would be better than that, which is actually implementing structural reform and taking charge of the situation and, you know, creating a more competitive economic environment. Because one of the big problems is, you know, this whole discussion is about, you know, debt to GDP. Mm-hmm. One of the solutions is to make GDP bigger, which is not what we're doing, right?
And we're dealing with people who don't see the cake as being, you know, something that can grow. They see the cake as being finite. That's just their economic model. That's the system that they're used to understanding.
I disagree with that. So I think there are I think there are people in the ANC who completely understand this and who are bound by politics. Okay. And then I think there are people in the ANC who just have, and particularly outside the ANC, who have really destructive views of how the economy should be governed, and kind of have, like, you know, mid-20th century views on mm-hmm. how an economy should be grown, right? Where we really should be focusing on competitiveness, on making sure that, you know, when you deploy a piece of capital in South Africa, it actually produces returns that are competitive with the rest of the world, which will ipso facto create capital formation in South Africa. And, you know, that's how a country gets richer. More capital that's working and producing returns, producing taxes, and producing jobs, right? And we're kind of like in the opposite of that, where capital is suboptimally returning, so there is no capital formation, and we actually have, in some cases, you know, like, there's a lot of analysis about industries and the amount of money they put in capital in South Africa, and literally, like, doing the minimum just to maintain the assets they have and taking money outside, right? Mm-hmm. So we almost have the opposite of capital formation happening right now, and that's, I think, the core of the whole situation of why we are where we are, and that's why I say that, you know, Tito's speech to me is depressing, because it doesn't even touch on those issues, right?
Well, come on. Do you agree with this this appraisal that there are people who do understand basic economics and supply and demand within the government? Canton, what do you think?
Yes, absolutely I do. I mean, certainly I think that that Tito does.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how much support do you think he gets from what Davi's just indicated, all these different areas? SACP clearly zero. Zero in terms of support. Factional breaks within the ANC, the unions.
It goes back to Ramaphosa's doorstep, because if Ramaphosa is actually not prepared to turn around and say, look, I fundamentally support the finance minister across the board, and look, I believe that that Ramaphosa actually does support Tito at that level, but because of the structures within the ANC right now, you know, his balance of power is so precarious that I think this is as far as he could go. And really, that is the, you know, the markets have priced that in. And they said, well, you know, clearly this shows that in as much as the president has told us that he's committed to doing all of these things, his ability to actually implement it is quite constrained.
All right, well, let's try and move on to other things, because there are lots of things going on in politics at the moment I'd like to have you to opine on. The first one is, let's talk about the DA and the recent happenings there. I know, Canton, we covered some of these last week, but what, Davi, is your take out about where the DA is at the moment? There seem to be two camps. There's one camp that thinks the DA is sliding backwards into a position which is not optimal for gathering support, and where their principles should come second to playing identity politics. And then there's another camp that says that actually principles do matter, and the color of skin of the leadership is less important than what their purpose is and what their values are.
This entire discussion for me is hung up on relatively minor, frankly irrelevant points in my view, right? So the discussion we just had is intrinsically tied to the discussion we're about to have about the DA, right? So the country is in very significant, deep economic trouble.
Yes.
The ANC, we've now discussed, in my view, and I think Canton agrees, and I think you agree as well, isn't and cannot fix it.
Yeah.
And by the way, it's baked into the election numbers. People also think the ANC are not going to fix it and are getting increasingly frustrated. You look at the election numbers, people are turning against
the ANC.
And you look at the wrong track, right track voting numbers. We have historically high wrong track numbers. And it's not like the kind of old school wrong track numbers where it's like middle class people and minorities. We're talking like core black in the township ANC voters who are really frustrated. The country's headed in the wrong direction. They're looking for an alternative, right? People are desperately looking for an alternative. And in that situation, right, you have the DA having it feels like a poll sci 101 class where we're debating what is our ideological principle on this little micro topic, etc., where the party should actually be focusing on or a party, whether it's the DA or not, but some party, I think maybe the DA, should be focusing on what is the fundamental solution to the current situation in the country. Because, by the way, if we don't develop a solution now, either the IMF is going to come and do it for us, which is going to be a very painful process. I know it sounds very nice, but actually a very painful process. Or, actually, before we get there, there's going to be an electoral swing away from the ANC. And if you haven't positioned yourself as the alternative now, the swing is going to be to the left. And that's going to be really problematic for South Africa. So, this whole discussion, I would almost label it as pathetic, because there should be a substantive policy discussion about what the party's solutions are to South Africa. And I do think both Musi and Helen are a little bit to blame that the party is where it is now, because this discussion should have happened 10 years ago. And the DA should have in the back room 10 PhDs from Harvard in development economics, developing a new comprehensive macroeconomic policy platform for South Africa, and then taking it to the country and selling it. So,
but Davi, we're living in a country, well, a world, you could argue, where this populist stuff seems to be what decides elections. I mean, we got Brexit going on or not going on, and now there's a new election in Britain, and people aren't interested in policy.
I disagree a little bit. I think that you can have very solid policy that actually explains to people very explicitly what's in it for them, right?
Yeah.
Trump had lots of policy. Trump's one policy was build the wall, hold immigrants out so that there's less labor supply in our country so that your wages are going up, and
messaging.
That's literally happening.
It's in the messaging.
Exactly, but but fundamentally in economics and in politics, good messaging is supported with substance that makes sense.
So in other words, if I distill what you've just said, you're seeing the DA running around looking at its own shadow instead of paying attention to the big things.
Exactly.
All right. Do you agree with that, Canton?
Well, there's just one thing I'd like to add, that if you want to summarize effectively what's happened with the DA over the past period, I'll say it in just one sentence. Musi Maimane polled fewer black votes in his election than Helen Zille did in the previous one.
That's false.
Really?
Yes.
If you drill down into the numbers around where the actual votes ended up going to across the board, just tell me how you think it's false, David, because when I drilled down into the numbers, it was very clear to me that that was the case.
So, I mean, I've done detailed demographic modeling of the election, and the DA won about 4% of the black vote in 2014. In 2019, they were up to about 4.8. So I agree, it's not significant growth.
Yeah, again, but you're talking percentages versus actual numbers.
Ah, okay, you're referring to nominal real numbers.
Exactly.
Sure. Okay. Lower turnout election with a higher percentage. I agree. Sure.
Exactly. Yes, that's my point.
But I would say in a lower turnout election, the more important point is what percentage is. But fine.
No, but that's not my point. You see, my point is that if you want to look in terms of the entire idea around what the DA was trying to achieve with this populist bent of theirs, was to try and gather more black people to vote for them than did previously. So the fact that they upped their percentage, but in real numbers couldn't persuade more black people to come out and vote for them, even though they were pushing this, what was the line that they used? We've now got 50% constitutional blacks in our lineup. And it did not, actually just didn't work for them from a point of view of trying to push a populist agenda. So what I'm trying to say, Gareth, you know, going back to your point, is that I don't think people actually understand what populism really means. I think that the thing that Darby was describing is far more accurate. You need very systemic messages that people can relate to, such as, you know, build the wall, kill the Iran deal, you know, get rid of
Muslims.
They're fundamental things that that Trump pushes, and they're all simplistic, and he keeps hammering them home, but they are things that resonate with the populace.
All right, Canton, I know you need to go, but I'm going to carry on talking to Darby, and the Burning Platform continues. Thanks for your contribution this morning. We'll see you next week.
Thank you, Canton.
All right. Awesome. Cool. Cheers, very guys. Good.
Darby, I want to talk about international politics for a second, because yes. I've read your take on the Democratic nomination coming up. At this point, Warren is ahead of Biden by 2%. What's going on there? I heard, and I regularly listen to Bill Maher, who I think is one of the smarter people on the left, and he had some interesting things to say about how, for most people in America, it's binary, right? It comes down to not these wedge issues, not these third rail issues. Mm-hmm. It's mostly for people about which one is worse in this situation, and they'll vote for the one that's less worse. Does that make any sense?
I think it's a very cynical view of politics, but maybe that's one perspective.
Well, I mean, he made the point that, like, Bernie Sanders, for example, reckons it's a good idea for the Boston Marathon bombers to be allowed to get free medical care in prison, and that Elizabeth Warren wants people who are transgender in prison to be able to get their sex reassignment surgery, their gender reassignment surgery, for free on the public wage bill, or rather the public, at the cost of the public, the taxpayer. That Kamala Harris would like, for example, to introduce herself with her pronouns every time she goes up onto a stage, and that all of these things actually don't matter. All you have to do, he says, if you're a Democrat in the United States, is just be less crazy than Trump.
so which is not that difficult.
So how we got Elizabeth Warren at the top here, who's, I mean, she's considerably left of where Joe Biden is.
Yes.
Right? We've got Bernie Sanders at 16. We've got Mayor Pete Buttigieg at like 7%. Is this the best that the Democratic Party can offer?
I think it's a great field. I think you're being very uncharitable.
Give me some positive stuff then.
So I think, look, one of the contextual trends that you have to just mention when you talk about American politics, right, is that the inequality in America is now the highest I think it's ever been. And particularly if you look at these analysis about like the top 1% and how much of the growth of the last 10 years or 20 years have gone to the top 1%, it's massive, right? Mm-hmm. So there is, I think, very significant pent-up frustration in middle-income America and middle-lower-income America about whether the American dream still exists, whether they have a fair deal. Like, if you've seen your factories close in rural Ohio, you want, and there's no other jobs, and you're working like minimum wage, and you only have high school, and you don't know really how to do programming, you can't find a job, it's not a nice situation, right?
But that's not the case right now.
Yes.
Unemployment's at an all-time low. We've got particularly minority unemployment all-time low. People aren't struggling for jobs. It's a busy economy. There's a lot being returned from the market.
So I was going to preface that with, that was a large part of the context of the Trump election, right? So I think people in middle America are very frustrated with deindustrialization in America, right? I do agree unemployment is low and there's certainly good economic growth going on, but it is still true that now, more than ever before, a disproportionate amount of that growth is going to basically the top 1% in America, right? And I think particularly in the Democratic Party,
so what?
There's real,
isn't that
there's real
what
hunger.
Happens with the Pareto Principle. Yeah, isn't this what goes on in nature and basic economics everywhere?
Look, you could argue that, you know, in the era that we are in now, where exponential technological growth is taking place and exponential value creation is taking place, the people who already have access to capital are going to exponentially benefit from it, right?
Correct.
And that's actually what's happening, right?
The standard of living for the average American is dropping.
But wait a minute. But the argument is that if we are in this new era where things are working a little bit differently and where there's this exponential value creation and it's disproportionately going to the top 1%, maybe, and this is the argument that Elizabeth Warren is making, right, and Bernie Sanders as well, is that maybe there needs to be some structural reform that is a bit different. Things need to be a little bit different now to ensure that the top 1%, because they own 90% of the capital, doesn't get 90% of the returns. Maybe we need to think about it differently by reforming healthcare, by reforming the way we do education.
But they've done the models, and I'm sure you've paid extra careful attention to this. Mm-hmm. Even if you tax the top 1% at whatever proportion Elizabeth Warren is saying you should,
It's
not going to pay for universal basic healthcare.
Yes, agreed. So you're going to have to tax the middle class,
right?
So this
is a moot point, to put it in your own language, when you were talking about the DA skirting around the real issue. It sounds to me like that's what Elizabeth Warren's doing too. And by the way, mm-hmm. psychologically, they've also done some assessments around the way people feel about this kind of thing. It's not because people care about the poor that they want to tax the rich. It's because they're full of resentment about the rich that they want to tax the rich.
So I haven't seen those studies, so I wouldn't be able to comment on that. But
I'll reference them for you later.
Okay, cool. But I think what's happening in the Democratic Party is that the debate we're having now is basically the debate that's happening in the party. So there are people that kind of the Warren plus Sanders wing of the party. I mean, I think it's something like 40%, right? If you add their polling percentages together, it's like 40-45% of the party. Then there's like the sort of slightly more sensible people, and I think Biden falls in that camp, Buttigieg falls in that camp.
45% of the Democratic base don't even consider themselves liberal.
Yeah, that's true.
So we're not talking about people who want to be leftist social Democrats like Bernie and Elizabeth Warren here. That's almost half the party that don't even think of themselves as liberal.
Yeah, agreed. And I think I do agree that I think most Americans, and I think all people everywhere, don't go into politics in the level of detail that we're going in this discussion, right? They think about it in sort of broad strokes mm-hmm. concept. So I think when people think about Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, they're not thinking like, you know, socialist medicine and this tax plan and that plan for this reform. They're kind of thinking about a little bit more of a it sounds like Elizabeth Warren is talking a lot about making a better deal for the middle class, and they don't actually fully are interested even in the details about that, but there's
maybe they just hear free stuff.
I think free stuff, but real reform that actually creates a fairer deal is something that I think is politically feasible.
Okay, but this obsession with equality, which you referenced right at the beginning of this discussion, is an obsession with equality only in the left. The right doesn't care about equality.
I disagree with that. So
not
I,
to the same degree.
So I think the left is more interested in equality of outcome, right? I think in the old left was interested in
liberal. It was equality of opportunity.
Exactly.
Which I think most people...
Which is now the right-wing position, basically.
But it's ironic that should be, because that seems like a reasonable position for anyone to take, at least from the outset. You can later, of course, modify your point of view to be about equality of outcome, but certainly that you'd be hard-pressed to find someone in the world who'd go, nope, people don't deserve the same equality of opportunity.
But I also think that no one is saying that, but the reality is that the way the American economy works now is that I don't actually think there is entire equality of opportunity. I think if you're born into a poor family, I mean, there are studies about this, about upward mobility and the extent to which people are able to move into different bands.
Davi, isn't America still the best country in the world for anyone who wants to make it from nothing to something?
But it is the worst show it has ever been, basically.
What do you mean? It's more difficult now than
it's
was
more
before.
Difficult. It's still the best, but it's more difficult than it's ever been before. And I think if you've only ever lived in America, then your lived experience is it is now less easy for my kids to get into, I don't know, a really great university.
It's probably because universities are becoming less and less important in the scheme of things, and probably rightly so, because universities have become indoctrination camps very much at the time. I mean, they are, especially in the social sciences and the humanities. Am I wrong? Look at the kind of people who they're churning out. Lesbian dance study graduates expect to be employed at 100,000 rand a month, $100,000 a year.
I studied at Yale, and I'm perfectly sensible, Gareth.
Yeah, but you went to Yale, and you didn't study social sciences.
I did some social sciences.
And what kind of people do you have in your class, out of interest?
Lesbian dance instructors.
And some very elite people who are in that top 1% probably, because only the best can afford to go to Yale.
Yes, but so that's exactly the point I'm making, right? So that's the point. So,
and if those are the people in control of the state and in control of the economic opportunities, then they're the people who are protesting too much about, oh, it's so unequal, but the ones benefiting from the inequality in the system anyway.
So that is exactly why lower income people in Ohio and Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin voted for Trump, and why I think some of them are now very seriously thinking about Elizabeth Warren. I'm not an Elizabeth Warren fan, actually, just for the record. I'm actually hoping someone else will win the nomination. But that, I think, is why she's polling at the top, and I think why her and Bernie together is something like 40% of the party.
Well, someone says, I'm not listening to you because I have made my mind up about everything. Well, that's not true. I want to hear, for example, what you think about the universal basic income that Andrew Yang has suggested.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What do you think of that, and what do you think its repercussions could be? What are the positive effects of something like UBI?
Yeah.
And would it ever be practically implementable?
I think it's a fantastic idea. Maybe I should, before I say that, just preface it a little bit. So there's been a lot of studies done about how to create not a perfectly equal but a more equal society, and what the sort of things that government can do to basically redistribute wealth to be a little bit more equal, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking particularly actually about the South African context.
Sure.
But yeah. And one of the things that the studies consistently say is that direct cash transfers are, at the end of the day, actually the most powerful way to do it. So you could do something like a BEE policy, right, which is a redistributive measure to make sure that people who are previously disadvantaged get an advantage in the economy, right? And that's one way of doing it. There are different
social engineering.
Yeah, there's different ways of doing it, which is just giving people money and giving them the freedom then to decide what to do with that money, right? So I'm theoretically, I don't know Andrew Yang's policy proposal down to the ninth detail, but theoretically, to me, if you wanted to do redistribution in a society that was unequal, like ours, like America to some extent,
sure,
direct cash transfers are a good idea. And I think, just stepping into America for a moment, I do think Yang's sort of riff about automation and these increased returns on capital, because capital is now doing more and more and returning more and more. But then, you know, the capital returns need to be redistributed a bit. That makes sense to me. I think that's a sensible argument. And then just stepping back to South Africa, I do think there's an argument here for rethinking the way we think about redistribution a little bit, because our redistribution framework right now, I think, is one of the core constraints and one of the core taxes, if you will, on capital returns in South Africa, right? I'm not saying don't do redistribution. I'm saying we must do redistribution. I think it's a moral and economic imperative to
do
so.
But isn't it already happening, because the tax base who are paying the majority of the taxes in this country are people who are either self-employed, people who are employed, and people who mostly make up the section of the population that's pulling the whole economy forward in any case?
Yep, absolutely. I agree that we have a very redistributive fiscal framework, right? The top 5 or 10% pays almost all the taxes.
So you'd like to see more of that?
Yes, I would like to see more of it, but I'd like to see it in a different form. Because what we've done is we've, as a kind of country, decided that we want to create more equal society, right? And how we'll do that is we'll have this taxing set up in government, but we will complement that with a number of kind of redistributive measures which place redistributive burden on the private sector, and particularly on returns on capital. Okay,
but the private sector can hardly afford that right now.
That's exactly the point I'm making. Is my view is that we should very seriously think about the redistributive framework that will maximize returns on capital, but simultaneously actually cause redistribution. And my view is that less of the burden should be on capital in the private sector, and more of the burden should be on the state. Now, we don't have a state that's actually capable of delivering distribution in person, physically. Mm-hmm. So what I'm not saying is build more hospitals is great.
They can't even get social grants out on time.
But do more stuff physically. Mm-hmm. My view is, if we're going to take redistributive burden away from the private sector to maximize capital growth and capital returns, to maximize capital formation and economic growth.
How do you see that happening, by the way? Is that deregulation? Is it more flexible and more lenient labor policy?
All of the above. So my view is, everything that everyone has ever discussed about creating a more competitive returns on capital in South Africa, we should very seriously look at. And I think basically implement. So all of that stuff. So, you know, people talk about special economic zones. It's where, you know, there's less regulation and things can be more competitive. It's sort of absurd that we would say, oh, that portion of the country should be a competitive special economic zone. Mm-hmm. My view is the entire damn country should be a special economic zone, right? But what I'm saying is, but if you do that, right, then companies are regulated. They have less of a burden to actually help poor people and do certain things to redistribute wealth, which I'm okay with, as long as we reshift in a fair way the redistributive burden to government. And given that government doesn't, in my view, have the practical capacity to actually administer it physically, I think the best way to administer it is with a cash transfer. So that's, in my view...
How much are we talking about here? Do you think it would make a difference in someone's life?
Like, way more.
How much? I mean, we've got currently our social grants are what, 800 odd rand a family, a person?
Yes. So, I mean, I haven't done the modeling, I haven't done the analysis, okay. So I wouldn't want to talk about numbers before doing that. But my view is if we wanted to have real wealth redistribution, you'd have to do it properly in the way that Andrew Yang is talking about it, right? Like real money.
What would that mean for someone who is in private business and is earning, let's say, 1 million rand a year, as Canton indicated earlier, the top 1% of South Africa. Okay, 1 million rand a year, how much should be taken away from them?
You'll have to do the modeling.
Okay,
but keep in mind, if you also...
And is it a one-off or is it continuous?
I would think about a kind of a more continuous long-term approach to it. So, I mean, the one-off thing is like a wealth tax that's a one-off transfer.
Okay, so in an economy that's not growing...
Yeah.
And in a place where you're already taxed just about close to half.
Yes.
And you're now going to have an additional burden of this redistributive model that you're talking about now. Why on earth would you want to run a business?
Because the regulations have been deregulated and government...
But that's not more money in your pocket.
I think so. I think if you really radically change the way that our government regulates business and particularly the redistributive burdens that are on business... I think that returns on capital will increase and investment will grow significantly.
And then just explain how you see this as being sustainable when there are already only, I think, 4 million income taxpayers in the country and 17 million grant recipients in the country.
Mm-hmm.
How is this a sustainable project in the long term?
I think if you grow your revenues from the private sector by having more capital formation, by having more economic growth, and by actually having a competitive economy... if you obviously it requires like massive kind of readjustment of expenditure in government, right? Like, I mean, NHI.
But let's at least get to that first. Let's at least start off with a situation where businesses can be more competitive and when they can do more.
Sure.
To make money in an unencumbered way, and then we can talk about redistribution. You can't put them both into play at the same time because it's not going to happen necessarily.
So,
the one may quash the other.
So the. The thing is, because we're talking about economics, right? And I think when you talk about economics, you need to think about politics as well, right? And in my view, you know, if the ANC has a model, which is the model we have now,
mm-hmm.
which is not working, right?
Correct.
And I think maybe if we're lucky, the Ramaphosa wing of the party is able to bring on incremental change that makes South Africa a bit more competitive and fixes certain things, if we're lucky, right? And incrementally. And I'm becoming more and more pessimistic that that will actually be the case. And even if they do those incremental changes, I don't think it's going to make like a massive
that much
difference.
Of a difference yeah.
I think we're just going to keep muddling on. Okay.
Cool.
The alternative, right, is I think starts with a political solution, right? Which is actually a political alternative that can govern without the current kind of complications and the current power dynamics in the ANC. So, right, so a government that doesn't have to phone COSATU for improvement on its solutions, right? And this whole conversation for me is framed about creating an alternative view of how the whole thing could work, both competitiveness and redistribution, because I just don't think you can get into government without a sensible, comprehensive...
I think you can, and the ANC's proven you can.
the ANC framework is perceived to be... A redistribution plan is perceived to be the best redistribution plan for South Africa, and that's why they're in government, in my view. And I think the party that has a sensible plan that people are convinced can work for them
mm-hmm.
is the party that will govern South Africa in the end, always.
All right. I'd like us to just move from there to...
We didn't talk about Pete Buttigieg, though.
Well, what do you want to say about Buttigieg?
He's great. I think he's going to win in Iowa, and I think that's gonna really create a very interesting situation. I think Biden
is... one of the battleground states.
It's the first nominating contest in the Democratic primary, and I think Biden has got a lot of soft support. So a lot of people just know him. They don't really like him that much. And I think at the end of the day, it's going to come down to Warren and Buttigieg.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. And then what do you forecast as perhaps being the result of an election between Elizabeth Warren and Donald Trump or Pete Buttigieg and Donald Trump?
It's going to be tight either way.
You think so? I think it's a landslide.
Blowout for Donald.
Yeah, I think he's going to do even better than he did in the last one.
I disagree a little bit. I think the way that the situation is set up, there's basically 45% of the country that loves the guy and 45% of the country that hates the guy. Mm-hmm. And I think that is kind of set. And I think both sides are going to turn out very heavily in this election. And it's kind of the 10% in the middle can go either way. And I think it'll be tight.
My point of view on this is that if it's Elizabeth Warren or Pete Buttigieg, I think there's a lot softer a support base there than you're talking about for Joe Biden. I think they'll turn out in a lackluster kind of lukewarm way for her or for him, I'm afraid. I just don't see either of them. You see, like politics, a lot of it's a posturing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And these two are not good at posturing. They both look like nice people. They seem to me to be good people with good ideas,
mm-hmm.
but they're just not strong.
So the whole turnout question, I like data, right? And I think the latest data we point to have is the 2018 midterm election.
Yeah, let's not forget the polls that predicted Hillary would win with 98% accuracy just before the 2016 elections when it comes to data, shall we?
Yeah, that's true, but...
People lie.
No. And that's a very good point. So polls is one thing, but actual election results is a different thing, right? Mm-hmm. And the last election that was in America was in 2018, the midterms. There, Democratic turnout was incredibly strong and animated by, I think, a desire to, you know, contain Trump.
Knee-jerk reaction from 2016 as well.
I think that knee-jerk reaction is going to continue into 2020.
Okay. All right, well, we'll take that bet, and we'll talk again in a couple of months' time.
That's good.
Let me hear what you think of Brexit and the fact that Boris has finally got an election in December. Does it make any difference? What are you expecting from that?
I think the Conservatives are well-positioned for that election, I think. If you look at the polling, they seem to be like 10 to 15 points like ahead. I think the Brexit, sort of the Nigel Farage Brexit vote... I suspect will collapse into the Conservatives, and it's looking like a good election for the Conservatives, but,
It's going to lead them into a situation of schism as well, where they've got Nigel versus Boris at some point.
Yeah.
Bound to happen, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Do you want to hear Boris's tribute to the Speaker?
I would love to.
All right, take a listen to this. This will leave things on a high note. This is Boris just kind of telling John Bercow what he thinks of him in his final time in the chair during Prime Minister's questions, and I don't know. This is kind of why I like politics. There are some witty, smart people, and sometimes they can be extremely funny.
Prime Minister.
There's the Prime Minister,
Thank
Boris Johnson.
Mr. Speaker, immediately after questions today, I will be opening the debate on the Grenfell Tower inquiry report. But, Mr. Speaker, I know the whole House will want to join me in recording that after 10 tumultuous years, this is your last Prime Minister's questions. And as befits a distinguished former Wimbledon competitor, you have sat up there in your high chair, not just as an umpire, ruthlessly adjudicating on the finer points of parliamentary procedure with your trademark Tony Montana scowl, Mr. Speaker. Not just as a commentator, offering your own opinions on the rallies you are watching, sometimes acerbic and sometimes kindly, but above all as a player in your own right, peppering every part of the chamber with your own thoughts and opinions, like some tennis ball machine, some uncontrollable tennis ball machine, Mr. Speaker, delivering a series of literally unplayable, unreturnable, formerly unreturnable, volleys and smashes. And although we may disagree about some of the legislative innovations that you have favoured, there is no doubt in my mind that you have been a great servant of this Parliament and of this House of Commons. You have modernised, you have widened access, you have cared for the needs of those with disabilities, and you have cared so deeply for the rights of backbenchers that you've done more than anyone since Stephen Hawking to stretch time in this particular session. And as we come to the end of what must be the longest retirement since Frank Sinatra, Mr. Speaker, I'm sure the whole House will want to join me in thanking you and hoping that you enjoy in your retirement the soothing medicament that you have so often described for the rest of us. And I know members from across the House will want to join me in wishing the England rugby team the very best for the final in the World Cup on Saturday. Mr. Speaker, this morning I had meetings with ministerial colleagues and others in addition to my...
All right, there we go. I think that's kind of funny. Good work from Boris, huh? Don't you think that's cute? All right, very nice. Well, Davi, it's a pleasure to spend some time with you. We have much to catch up on in a year's time, or actually less than that, because we'll be seeing what the Americans do at the polls next year. And hopefully in between, we'll also be able to catch up on some of your economic plans and your view of progress or the lack thereof in terms of our own more domestic issues. But thank you very much.
Thanks, Gareth.
What a pleasure. So it's very nice to have Davi Skultz here. It's very nice to have Canton on the line. And very nice to have you join us this morning on The Burning Platform, which is brought to you by Nando's. Another extra hot morning. We will see you tomorrow. CliffCentral.com